And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Next week, in the nation's capital, advocates and friends of America's wilderness will be hiking the halls of Congress to inspire, cajole, and negotiate with members of the House and Senate, as well as the White House, to continue designating lands as wilderness. There's some interesting news coming from the wilderness these days, as Americans from traditionally diverse interests are finding common ground in the backwoods and the byways. Today, we're headed to the mountain with Doug Scott of the Campaign for America's Wilderness and a bunch of his friends, and that includes you, as he and many others unite to take a stand for wilderness in this special edition of the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
One of America's greatest achievements is the establishment of a national wilderness system. Its roots reach deep into the American land and its people, beginning with the original North Americans, who set up a vast, interconnected, multinational system in which people and nature lived in a naturalistic balance. Those who came after were awed by the grandness and wonder of the lands, which inspired the emergence of some of our greatest writers, Thoreau, Emerson, Whitman, who wrote eloquently of the spiritual union of our nation and its land with its merciful celebration of freedom and human justice. Those early footsteps into the wild places left deep tracks in which we follow today. But the paths have narrowed, and the destinations continue to fall to the ongoing quest of humankind to seek an easier, more prosperous life. And that is where the paths diverged, where the forests met the clearings, and so it has continued. And the struggle to preserve forever America's sacred lands now must be fought in the halls of Congress. And so it is that next week, wilderness advocates from around the nation head to the nation's capital to wrangle and wrestle the words and wills that result in the legal protections required as forged in the great legacy of the wilderness movement. In honor of this sacred journey, the Wildside News dedicates this show to all of us who wish we could be in Washington to take our stand. So we begin today's show with a meeting of all of us on a mountain and a wilderness with a living wilderness legend, Doug Scott, who embodies the spirit of wilderness in his writings on the history, the challenges, and the future of our American wilderness. Doug inspires us all to understand our place in the ongoing passing of wilderness to the generations yet unborn, who send us their prayers for wisdom. And as with any struggle, there are times of celebration and times of defeat. In reality, we have much that says we must maintain our vigilance, as those divergent paths have seemed so far apart. And yet, those who read the compass closely are whispering about what some say seems to be a crossroads up ahead, where the trails are leading back to the wilderness as a place of common ground. In our second segment, we head to Idaho and talk with Rick Johnson, executive director of the Idaho Conservation League, which helped Idahoans from all walks meet in the wilderness on common ground, as an historic 300,000 acres are about to be designated as wilderness, something that has not happened in a very long time in Idaho. In segment 3, we end our journey on the shores of the Pacific, at the Pacific Star Winery with its owner, Sally Otteson, who grew up immersed in wilderness ethics, which are alive and well, in fact and in spirit. She talks about the pending designation of the Northern California Coastal Wild Heritage Wilderness Act, which is about to be made official in the halls of power, in a unique bipartisan success story. This is a special invitation for all of the friends of the wilderness, the regulars and the new who are listening to this show, to join us now as we head into the mountains to the clearing in the wilderness. It's a bit of a hike, but it will be a moment you can say to your children's children, I was there. And so, let's head out. want to thank all of you for joining us here in the meadow. This is the perfect backdrop to talk about wilderness. So now, I want to introduce our guide to take us on a journey through the legends of the American wilderness, Doug Scott.
Here in this meadow, with the sun going down after a pretty strenuous but delightful hike up that creek and up to this high meadow, we get this terrific vista off across the mountain range, those high peaks, the deep forest that we're looking down into. I see way off in the distance sagebrush deserts kind of shimmering there. And it, at a place like this, it's well to ponder the glory that is ours as Americans to have a rich history of wilderness as a part of our lives. Of course, the indigenous native peoples were here long before most of our forebears arrived in this on this continent. And in a sense, the first Europeans thought that America was this just vast, unsettled wilderness. The native peoples had, of course, found a way to live in accommodation with nature that we can only admire. But to European stock, this whole continent was like the scene in front of us here, unexplored, wild, rich in resources, potentially unknown. And over the relatively brief period in which we drove American civilization across the continent, up every river valley, and settled and cultivated and cleared the land, the very act of coming to terms with the wilderness imbued in the American character some values that we still think are so important today, values of fierce independence and rugged individualism and strong sense of community, the very characteristics of pioneers that became a part of in our frontier encounters, even as we conquered so much of the wilderness. Well, today, when we visit a wilderness area like this one, we are cherishing those same values. We're reconnecting in some special way. We're reconnecting with the natural world, to be sure. This is nature at its wildest, at its grandest. But we're also connecting in some deeper way with all of that essence of what our historical encounter with the American land has been like. And many of us believe that, and certainly I think from our conversation along the trail, those of you that are with me today, many of us believe that this wilderness, preserving areas like the one we're visiting, is so essential to the future that as valuable as we find these recreational opportunities, as valuable as we find just being able to view out at the vista of a wild natural scene, think how much more valued that opportunity will be to future generations who will live in a more crowded world with more stress, with more more challenges in their lives, but to have some of the original American earth. And somewhere in all of that is the deeper meaning of why we as a country have decided to preserve a generous sample of the American wilderness for future generations. And so I'm going to talk for a little while about why we do that. But to me it seems very important to stress the impulse that lies behind the work that so many ordinary citizens do, getting together with their neighbors, forming organizations, forming coalitions to try and encourage the preservation of wilderness areas that they know and love. And when I think about that, I think about something that the great Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas wrote in 1965. He wrote that, "Today we look backward to a time when there was more wilderness than the people of America needed. But today we look forward, and only a matter of a few years, to a time when all the wilderness now existing will not be enough. And to me, those words of Justice Douglas explain why our generation is at this pivotal moment of responsibility and opportunity. We still have the wilderness to preserve, but the wilderness that our future generations will ever know will only be that that in a relatively short period of time we make the decision to preserve today. And that is behind the impulse that's led people to try and figure out how to preserve wilderness areas. So we had, clear back in 1872, the idea that led to the creation of the world's first national park, Yellowstone, this large 2 million acre expanse of wild country far from where most people lived at that time, set aside for future generations as a great national park. And that started a whole process that has since swept around the world. And over the years, national forests were established, more national parks, national wildlife refuges. A lot of federal land remained in federal ownership in one category or another. And starting in the 1920s, some folks in the U.S. Forest Service led by Aldo Leopold. Those of us who know Aldo Leopold's work through the San County Almanac think of him as the great land ethicist. Really one of the fathers of modern environmental thinking. But early in his career, he was a forest ranger down in the Southwest, in Arizona and New Mexico, and he conceived the idea that some chunks of that landscape on the national forests, on federal land, ought to be preserved as wilderness, as places where people could get out and leave their motors behind and get out on the trail, maybe with a pack string, maybe with a backpack, and reconnect with the pioneer skills and with the wilderness. And so his agitation led finally to a decision by the Forest Service in 1924 to establish the world's first wilderness area. And it was done by an order of the regional forester. He just signed a document that said this area of some hundreds of thousands of acres will be the Gila Wilderness Area. And it seemed like a good idea, and so over the next few years, Forest Service officials around the country established some additional areas, again, by this same kind of administrative order. So that by 1939, there were about 14 million acres of wilderness on the national forests, almost all of it in the West, that were protected in this way by administrative orders. And then World War II came along, and there was a period of distraction, and that's really when the Forest Service stopped designating additional areas as wilderness, and instead they started through a process of trying to decide which of those original 14 million acres of areas they would protect with some degree of permanence, and they went through this process, and what happened as they were doing this was that the boundaries got fiddled with. And whereas back in the 1920s or 1930s, an area might have included a lot of good forest area, those trees that might now be wanted by somebody to be logged would suddenly be excluded from the revised boundary of the wilderness. In other words, the permanence that wilderness advocates like Aldo Leopold sought was too easily changed when it was just a matter of wilderness being protected by administrative orders. And this dissatisfaction with the way that wilderness was being preserved at that time is what led to the Wilderness Act that is the tool we use today to preserve wilderness. And that dissatisfaction led people who cared about wilderness to look really fundamentally at the question of how, if you want to preserve an area of land in its wildest condition, without roads and motors, how, in our system of government, can you go about that? And these people, Aldo Leopold, Bob Marshall, Benton Mackay, many of them the founders of the Wilderness Society, which had been organized in 1935, they met frequently to wrestle with these concepts, and they were fired by this idea that wilderness was not just some luxury, not just a kind of recreation area, but that the values of wilderness were something broader and deeper, and that they weren't some luxury, but they were a fundamental human need. And that we would in some way be impoverished as a culture if we let all our wilderness be developed and changed and become human-dominated. And at the same time, because they felt so strongly that these wilderness areas had these deeper values, they also wanted to preserve them in perpetuity. That's kind of an unusual word. What it means is forever. You know, we humans talk about the future. Sometimes we speak of our grandchildren's children. We sort of talk about people we might know, our children's children. But this idea of perpetuity is much longer than that. It's our children, children, grandchildren, 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 dot, dot, dot. It on into the future, forever. And so they were fired by this idea that wilderness was essential, had many values that were essential to our culture, and that we needed to preserve it forever. Well, how the devil to do that? How to guarantee that permanence? And they were increasingly disappointed that relying on administrative promises by agencies like the Forest Service or the National Park Service simply wasn't good enough. And so a number of these people, meeting at the annual gathering of the Governing Board of the Wilderness Society in 1947, up in northern Minnesota, they sat around the campfire and they decided that they needed to launch a campaign for a stronger way of preserving wilderness, and that was the start of the campaign for the Wilderness Act. And they turned to the executive director of the Wilderness Society, a man named Howard Zonizer, and they turned to him and said, Zonny, which was his nickname, you try and find a way to conceive of a law that will preserve wilderness and try and imagine a way that such a law could ever be actually passed by Congress. And so starting in 1947, Howard Zonizer and his colleagues started having quiet conversations with many people, members of Congress, leaders of the Forest Service and the National Park Service and other federal agencies, conservation leaders from around the country. And it took a period of 9 years of those kind of discussions before they sensed that the time was right and they'd gathered enough consensus among the people they were talking to that this was a worthy goal. And in 1956, Howard Zonizer sat down and put pen to paper to start drafting what became the Wilderness Act. And here on this mountainside this afternoon, I won't go into the long history of the 8-year campaign it took for Congress to actually pass the law. So we can jump ahead to a scene in the we see on our television pictures all the time of the President of the United States, in this case Lyndon Johnson, gathered with a number of members of Congress around him at a desk set in the Rose Garden at the White House. And on September 3rd, 1964, he signed the Wilderness Act. And the Wilderness Act of 1964 is widely viewed as one of the most historic conservation achievements of American history and indeed of world history. Today, our Wilderness Act has become the model and the inspiration for wilderness laws all around the country, for wilderness preservation policies in South Africa and Botswana and Finland and Russia and New Zealand, and many other countries are exploring this opportunity to preserve wilderness areas where they still can do so. The Wilderness Act, when it became law in 1964, reflected a series of important political decisions. We have to remember that while Congress was debating the wilderness law in the late 1950s and early 1960s, this was way before Earth Day. The flowering of environmental consciousness was just barely beginning in this country, led by a lot of sportsmen's groups, hunting and fishing groups, the National Wildlife Federation, birding groups like the National Audubon Society, outdoor groups like the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society. And these groups, who were the mainstays in pressing the campaign for the Wilderness Act, had to grapple with a number of realities. One of the realities that's embraced in the Wilderness Act and our processes for thinking about how to preserve wilderness areas is that as idealistic as this idea of preserving wilderness is, of identifying some wonderful place on the federal lands like this grand spot where we're visiting today and saying we ought to preserve this, we ought to draw a line around it and make it a wilderness area, that idea is coming to that landscape after all sorts of other things have happened. American progress has already, in many ways, settlement patterns have been established, and so preserving wilderness has to be fit into the realities of the time. And they confronted this on the authors of the Wilderness Act and the members of Congress who worked for it had to fit the Wilderness Act to practical realities. So I think of this as this amazing story of the idealism of wilderness thinkers and pioneers and advocates married with the practicalities of a very political reality that they had to deal with realities on these federal lands. For example, at that time and still today, numerous areas on our national forests and other federal lands are under permit, are being used for livestock grazing. Typically it's the summer range. A rancher who lives near a federal land will move his cattle or his sheep up for a period of time into higher meadows and higher pasturing on the federal lands. Well, some of those federal lands that are subject to this permitted grazing are areas that are being designated as wilderness. And so the question is, what do you do about the grazing? And as they worked out the Wilderness Act, the members of Congress and the wilderness advocates had to grapple with that reality, and they worked out an arrangement where those existing grazing rights, if it was already there, would be recognized and protected, even though the area was being made a wilderness area. And so it's a step back from the ideal to recognize a political reality on the ground that this use already exists and is permitted. Now, maybe someday it will no longer be there, but in the meantime, if we're going to preserve this wilderness, imperfect though it is, of course, because it has this other use that isn't consistent with the ideal of wilderness, they had to work through our political system of accommodations and some degree of compromise to come to a law that they could enact. And so the Wilderness Act, when it passed, was it supported, of course, by the conservation groups, but it also was approved by and agreeable to the National Cattlemen's Organizations that represented those grazing interests. And accommodations of that kind are reflected in the Wilderness Act in one way or another, and that's one of the reasons it proved possible to enact the law. One of the biggest fights in Congress that held up action on the Wilderness Act for a long time was the demand by people who weren't so enthusiastic about the Wilderness Act, but who were in key positions of power in the Congress, to say, rather than some process by which wilderness areas sort of automatically get established if the president recommends them, we in Congress want to be in control of this. And so they made the decision, which was adopted in the Wilderness Act, wasn't the way the original proposal was thought of by the conservation groups, but Congress made the decision that it would take an act of Congress to preserve each new wilderness area. If an area of federal land was going to be preserved under the strong protections of the Wilderness Act, which allows no road building, no mechanical equipment, protects the wilderness values of the area, the decision to designate that area would take an act of Congress. And so these kind of accommodations to the practical realities of our political system were a part and parcel of the history of our wilderness system. And so did they achieve a law that was able to work in the practical world? Well, let's look at the results. The Wilderness Act became law 42 years ago. And at that moment, it only extended its legal protection, the protection of statutory law, to 9 million acres of land. And it said that any additional lands, that federal lands, that were going to be protected under this law would have to be taken an additional act of Congress passed in the future to designate those areas. Well, looking back from 42 years later, Congress has passed well over 130 additional laws adding lands to the National Wilderness Preservation System protected by the Wilderness Act of 1964, and those additional laws have brought in 11 times as much land. So a wilderness system that started 42 years ago as 9 million acres now includes almost 107 million acres of land. A very large increase, and each one gotten to that point of being preserved and designated as a wilderness area only because local citizens, federal agency officials, members of Congress came to an agreement that allowed an act of Congress to be passed that preserved that additional land. It's an amazing story of citizen activism that I'll return to here in a minute, but it does seem to me that I've used a word here that we need to discuss a little bit more, and that's the word designate. When Congress passes a law designating a wilderness area, this wilderness area we're enjoying our visit to today, when Congress passed the law that designated this area as a wilderness area, that law included a map with a precise boundary. And the boundary is part of the law. And by designating the land within that boundary as a wilderness area, Congress put it under the protective provision of the Wilderness Act of 1964, which says there can be no road building, there can be no use of mechanical equipment, no mechanized, no motorized equipment, and the area is preserved for its wilderness qualities. In essence, if you were to walk into such an area, you are leaving the 21st century behind. You're returning to a different way of relating to nature. And Congress having designated that wilderness area, the secret to its permanence, and Congress can always change its mind, but the secret to the preservation of the wilderness is simply that Congress having included that boundary as a part of the law itself, only Congress can change it in the future. This has happened. It's happened in a number of cases where there's been good merits for making an alteration in a wilderness boundary. But it doesn't happen easily, and it doesn't happen casually, because it takes another act of Congress. In northern Utah, there's a wilderness area that was protected by Congress in 1984. It's called the Mount Naomi Wilderness. And it's literally in the mountains that rise right from the edge of the city of Logan, Utah. And in drawing the boundary in 1984, an error was made. And everyone later recognized that it was an error, and it caused some practical problems. And the boundary, in a couple of places, just went someplace that wasn't going to work out. And so Congress went back and passed a law in 2003, signed by President George W. Bush, that altered that boundary to correct that error. And everyone agreed, the local conservation groups, and the Utah congressional delegation, and this law was passed. It changed the boundary of the Mount Naomi Wilderness by 31 acres. It took an act of Congress to make an alteration of just 31 acres. That's the power of the Wilderness Act. That it once an area is designated, and I can tell you, the citizen campaigns to get some of these areas designated take a good long time. There's often resistance. It takes a while to build the consensus that allows an act of Congress to be passed. But once it's passed, the burden of proof shifts, and anyone who wants to come in and say, in the future, hundreds of years from now, we think this area ought not to be a wilderness area anymore, they have the burden of proof of passing a new act of Congress. And that's the secret to the permanence that the visionaries who thought up the Wilderness Act, that's the secret to the permanence that the Wilderness Act gives to these areas. And so we can think about this glorious scene we're looking at here out across the forest and those beautiful ridges over there as the sun begins to set. We can think about that natural area that we're looking at as an area that the American people, through their elected representatives, have decided to preserve forever as wilderness. And a federal law drawing this boundary protects this area until the Congress, of the whole Congress of the United States, might someday in the future choose some other decision. But the assumption is this wilderness area is preserved forever. That idea has enormous magic in it. There, I can't tell you, as I travel around the country and meet with people who are working to preserve areas that they know and love, where they've hiked and visited since they were children, perhaps, I can't tell you the ardor that you hear in people's voices as they talk about what it is about this wilderness area that inspires them to seek its permanent preservation. And I can't tell you the excitement in the voices of those who've had a success in preserving an area like the one we're visiting today, who say, as an ordinary citizen, I was able to participate in the campaign that led the Congress of the United States to make a permanent decision, as permanent as our system allows, to preserve this area as the wilderness area. And when you think about that, it's the power of grassroots, ordinary people making our democracy work. And I've seen this example. I think of Nancy Hall, who was a waitress in a cocktail waitress in a casino in Nevada, who just had a place she loved in the deserts on the federal lands outside of her community, where she just loved to go hiking and visit the wilderness. And today, that wilderness area, the Lime Canyon Wilderness, 23,000 acres of it, is protected by the Wilderness Act, in part because of the work that Nancy Hall did to help Congress make that decision, to go to Washington, to testify, to visit with her own congressman and enlist his support on the basis of her enthusiasm for the area and to help work out the practical problems that came up. I worked with a woman years ago in the Central California Mountains, a woman who had a pear orchard, and she grew organic pears. They were wonderful, dried pears. And on the horizon from her property was a part of a national forest called Snow Mountain. And the Forest Service was going to make a decision that was going to lead to the development of new roads and new logging on Snow Mountain. And she just didn't think that was the right decision. And Catherine Pedersen, this pear orchardist, probably to her surprise, before long found herself engaged with other local citizens working on this project. She came to Washington, D.C. She and I trudged around the halls of Congress, visiting members of Congress. She gave them samples of her wonderful organic pears, which certainly enlisted their interest. But Catherine Pedersen can feel that she was a pivotal citizen activist in the success of designating what is now the 36,000-acre Snow Mountain Wilderness that's preserved permanently. there in the mountains, not so far from her home. And those stories, there's story after story of those kind of people working to preserve areas that they feel so strongly about. And in the short run, that may mean that they've had to protest and object to a logging project or to a new road project that would invade the wild country they love. But over time, rather than simply constantly being on the defensive of one project after another that somebody might propose that would invade the wilderness that they cared about, they could take positive action. Using the Wilderness Act of 1964 and going to our Congress, using our democratic processes, to see ultimately that area became a wilderness area and logging projects were no longer allowed. And road building was no longer allowed. The area, a decision had been made that this area would be preserved as wilderness. Well, what are the functions of wilderness? People are, obviously, a lot of people care about preserving these areas. Congress, after all, has responded to public concerns from people all over the country and has designated wilderness areas now in 44 of our 50 states. The Sipsey Wilderness in northern Alabama, the Great Swamp Wilderness in suburban New Jersey, on part of a national wildlife refuge, just 26 miles from Times Square, the Great Wilderness in the Gates of the Arctic National Park, and slopping over into the Noatak National Preserve, two national park units that adjoin in the Central Brooks Range of Alaska, and there one expanse of unbroken wilderness, 13 million acres in size. That's six Yellowstones in size, and without any road at all. This is a diverse system of lands. They serve many different uses. The obvious use that we think about is the one we've enjoyed today, a companionable group enjoying a hike, sometimes slightly out of breath, up a steep slope, but with this fabulous view here in the wilderness as our goal. People out enjoying wilderness areas for recreation, for family picnicking, for backpacking, for a special hunting trip on the National Forest wilderness areas that are open to hunting, for example, for bird watching, for taking a grandparent, taking a grandkid on the first fishing trip to a wild stream in the Appalachian Mountains in the Shining Rock Wilderness Area in North Carolina. Scene after scene of people using these areas, not with motors, not with 21st century contrivances of civilization, but in a more fundamental way, getting in touch with nature. And so maybe we would be tempted to think that, well, wilderness areas are for outdoor recreation. That's why we have wilderness areas. But that just scratches the surface, because wilderness areas serve many other functions. They protect watersheds that provide clean water. This is a reason that in Oregon, east of Portland, Oregon, where there's a lot of apple and pear orchards in the Hood River Valley, citizens there have been in the forefront, owners of those orchards, and have been in the forefront of wanting to protect their watershed in the high mountain nearby on the slopes of Mount Hood, and been supporting a wilderness bill that would preserve, in Congress, that would preserve that area, pending in Congress in the fall of 2006. And they're, sure, they may also go hiking in that area, but they also value this as a fountain of clean water, a protected watershed, wilderness areas as places that we know we're preserving the habitat essential to wildlife. So that we have robust populations of wildlife for people to enjoy. The wilderness areas providing the habitat for particularly for endangered species. Think of areas in Idaho and Wyoming and Montana where the wilderness is the essential habitat for the grizzly bears that used to roam so much of the, even out onto the prairies. but now have been pushed up into these wilderness areas in the northern Rocky Mountains. And how excited Americans are to see grizzly bears when they visit Yellowstone or Glacier National Park. Well, wilderness areas are the kind of are the habitat that protect these that sort of endangered species. So wilderness areas serve a wide variety of functions and uses and have value to people, including value that doesn't involve actually visiting the wilderness area at all. Many of us feel so strongly that we have an obligation to pass a legacy of wilderness to future generations. And surely it is that sense of obligation to the future to preserve a place, even though we have no expectation of ever visiting it ourselves, a place like the North Slope of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, so much in the news as a controversy where this is an area still not protected as wilderness, where the oil companies and some of their supporters would dearly love to drill for oil. But that oil drilling on an industrial scale across that magnificent coastal plain of the Arctic would destroy the wilderness qualities and the wildlife habitat that presently exists there. And thousands upon thousands of Americans are writing their congressmen and telephoning and emailing and engaged in working to preserve, to block the oil drilling there and to preserve that as a wilderness area, never expecting to go there themselves. Relatively few people do. But out of a sense that we have an obligation, it's a wildlife habitat. We ought to simply preserve it for the caribou and the grizzly bears and the wolves, but also that we have this extraordinary sense of obligation to pass areas like that on undefiled to future generations. And so wilderness has this legacy value, the scenic value of wilderness. Just the other day, I found myself on a long drive through central Oregon and central Washington through the Cascade Mountains, and I only had the briefest time to actually walk in the wilderness areas, but I passed by the edges of a number of areas that Congress has preserved under the Wilderness Act, and I was drinking in their wildness through the windshield of my car. I was standing on the edge of a road or sitting in a picnic area having my lunch, surrounded by the wilderness scene just starting just a few feet away from me, along a highway in the Oregon Cascade, where the wilderness boundary is literally a stone's throw from the edge of the highway. And people who are traveling across that mountain pass are seeing this vista of wildness all around them on both sides of the road, preserved by wilderness. They're on a road corridor that's only 132 feet wide, and it's preserved wilderness by act of Congress just beyond that corridor on both sides. And they are using that wilderness. After all, they didn't come to choose that road to admire the view, to admire the road itself. It's a nice road. But they came to be surrounded by this vista of wildness around them, and surely they're using that wilderness even though they never set foot within it. And so there's these scenic values and this legacy we owe to future generations. These are the things that fire so many of us with our passion for the preservation of wilderness areas. And that the progress that is being made year after year in preserving more wilderness seems to me to be a huge testament to the idealism of those who gave us this idea of preserving wilderness, but also a huge testament to their practical instincts, to their devising a means that uses the political processes of our legislative body, the Congress of the United States, and that understands that in that process there will be accommodation to other users who have interests in the same land. There will be a compromise. Boundaries may get shifted here and there. For example, mountain bikes are not allowed in wilderness areas. They are a mechanical contrivance that would really be at completely at odds with the ideal of wilderness as a place where we leave all of our mechanisms and our mechanical contrivances behind us. But lots of people love to mountain bike. And there are lots of places on our public lands where mountain bikes are allowed and perfectly appropriate. Well, sometimes it becomes necessary to work out an arrangement whereby boundaries of a proposed wilderness might be altered slightly to be sure that a trail that is popular with mountain bikers and is a priority for mountain biking groups can be accommodated. And those kind of arrangements are reflected then in the legislation that Congress may enact. There's just such a piece of legislation pending in Congress in the fall of 2006 involving national forest areas in the mountains of Virginia. And the legislation itself reflects an agreement worked out by local people, some of them mountain bikers, some of them wilderness people. You know, an awful lot of people who love to backpack in the wilderness and don't want to see bicycles there have a mountain bike in their garage and enjoy using it other places at other times. And an awful lot of people who have mountain bikes love to throw a backpack on their back and leave their bicycle behind them and go off into the wilderness. So these kind of accommodations are a part of the genius of our political system. And it goes back to this story of Howard Zonizer and Bob Marshall and Aldo Leopold and these other pioneering leaders who combined an intense idealism for the preservation of wilderness for all these reasons I've been discussing with a practical sense of how to get things done in our political process. And sometimes people at the extremes, people who say it's never okay to compromise this before any action should be taken, it should be perfect. Or people who represent off-road vehicle groups and are just absolutely opposed to any wilderness. Well, people at the extremes aren't where progress is made. It's where people can get together. And so much progress is being made right now in the Congress. This fall of 2006 that we're looking forward to here as we're visiting this wilderness area, Congress has before it legislation that could protect up to a couple million acres of new wilderness lands in Nevada and Idaho and the Boulder White Clouds Mountains and around Mount Hood on the Mount Hood National Forest in Oregon and in the mountains of Virginia and in the National Forest in forests in Vermont and New Hampshire, in Washington State, north of Seattle, and in a national forest area, fabulous areas in along the north coast of California. This legislation is pending in Congress. Legislation for wilderness in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. And it's propelled by this energy of citizen enthusiasm for wilderness preservation, combined with accommodations that have been worked out that make it practical for Congress to move ahead to enact this legislation. And that's part of the reason it becomes practical is that by working out reasonable accommodations, the coalition behind a particular proposal becomes broader and broader. It includes the sportsmen. It includes the mountain bike community. It includes the church groups and all manner of the county commissioners, local business owners. And it becomes something that represents a social consensus. And then it has every reason to be likely to be embraced by the Congress of the United States and approved by the Congress. This story is not over. My time of talking with you is, but this story is not over because this work is continuing. And I traveled recently for a week in West Virginia, meeting with local people all through West Virginia who were working on plans to preserve areas on the Monongahela National Forest. Fabulous wild places on this national forest and stretching much of the length of the state of West Virginia. And those decisions won't be made in Congress in 2006. They're likely to be made in 2007 or 2008. And so these people are merely getting ready with their plans, just like people in Montana working in a wonderful progress of sitting down between conservation group leaders and the owners of timber mills to try and work out arrangements so that those timber mills can thrive and prosper, and there'll be that economy can be protected, and so can wilderness areas. And so there's an agenda for immediate action in the Congress yet in 2006, and there's an agenda for the future of similar proposals all across this country. And behind every one of them is this mix of practical political skills practiced by ordinary people getting together in groups and coalitions, mixed with and fired by their deep idealism to see preserved areas they've known as wilderness in their lifetime and that they want to see preserved for the future. To me, it's an incredibly inspiring story. It's a story of real progress, a story of a real commitment to the legacy we owe to the future, and it's a story of our American democracy working. And to me, that is extraordinarily important. Well, we'll have plenty of time as this campfire gets going and around the embers after dinner to discuss some of these ideas, but I know some of you are not going to be camping with us tonight and are heading back, it's been a tremendous opportunity to talk with you a little bit about the excitement of working for wilderness preservation. Others of us are going to get started on dinner and our camping arrangements here. It's going to be a starlit night. I could just see that it's going to be a fabulous sunset and a terrific opportunity. And then tomorrow afternoon when we get back to the cars and head back to town, a couple of us are going to be getting on an airplane and heading to Washington, D.C., straight from the heart of this wilderness. To take the message about that area, that ridge over there in the distance, that's the part of this area that has not yet been preserved by Congress, but its legislation is proposed, it's pending in Congress. We've got the chance to enact it yet this year to expand this wilderness, to include that not only that ridge, but down there, lower in the valley. When this wilderness was first established, it was all these high mountain peaks that we're among up here, but it didn't include that low valley and that ecosystem, and it turns out that the wildlife need that as well, so we have the opportunity to improve the ecological protection of this whole area by the addition of that ridge and that valley, a couple of us are headed to Washington, D.C. to work on that, I know the rest of you will be writing your letters and making your phone calls, because that's the heart of this citizen activism. I guess I have one other thought to share with you, and that is, it is so easy in our political system today, drenched in media coverage of every scandal, it is so easy for the American people to get a message just constantly about cynicism, that's cynical about our political process. But I've been working in wilderness preservation for almost 40 years now, working closely with the Congress through that whole period. And I must say, I come from that experience with a deeper sense of patriotism, with a deeper sense that we have a political system that can answer, can respond to the will of the people if the people organize themselves and take their message to Congress, not in a way that is cynical and conniving, but in a way that is saying, here's an idea that we're so excited about, that we think the whole Congress ought to be excited about, that we can do something terrific for the American people, not just of our generation, but for all the future. We can preserve this wilderness area by law. It can be the law of the land. And just think how future generations who won't know our name, but think the gratitude they'll have that we had the wisdom, that we had the sense of restraint, that we had the humility to preserve for them.